Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the head of the UN Human Rights Commission saying there is massive evidence of crimes against humanity as she implicates the Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad in authorizing war crimes. With the London-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights release of its latest estimate of 125,835 killed in Syria's civil war, Middle East expert Henri Barki, who served on the U.S. State Department's policy planning staff, joins us to discuss this less than surprising finding from the UN's Commission of Inquiry into Syria and how it might affect next month's Geneva II peace conference. Then we'll get an analysis of the second Orange Revolution underway in Ukraine following the rejection by the embattled Yanukovych regime of an association agreement with the European Union. Alexander Motel, a professor of political science at Rutgers University and author of Dilemmas of Independence, Ukraine After Totalitarianism, joins us to discuss whether the corrupt and unpopular Yanukovych will be the world's only leader to have been twice driven out by people power. Then finally, as Vice President Biden visits Tokyo, Beijing, and Seoul to both assure allies and reduce tensions with China, we will get a critical appraisal of China's recent assertion of territorial claims that has riled the Japanese and South Koreans. An expert on the Chinese military, June Dreyer, a professor of political science at the University of Miami, joins us to discuss the regional and global test of power going on in the East China Sea and the risks of escalation and miscalculation. And joining us now is Henri Barki, who's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the U.S. State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. He has authored, co-authored, and edited five books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. His most recent book is European Responses to Globalization, Resistance, Adaptation, and Alternatives. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Barki.
Thank you.
And the United Nations fact-finding team have found massive evidence at the highest levels of the Syrian government that they're responsible for war crimes in this horrible civil war that I just mentioned the figures released on the latest casualty figures. Navi Pillay didn't name President Bashar al-Assad, but she said evidence collected by her Commission of Inquiry on Syria implicates the head of state. Is this going to resonate in any way?
Unfortunately not, in the sense that, A, this is not a surprise. I mean, we've known and the world has known for a long time that the regime has engaged in massive violations of human rights and war crimes. So this doesn't come as a surprise. But it also, the real problem is that it comes at a time when the regime feels very self-confident, not only of its ability to withstand the onslaught of the rebels, but is also very confident of the support it has from Russia, China, and Iran in particular. Had this report come out, let's say, 6 months to a year earlier, then it would have had much more of an impact, because President Assad of Syria was on shakier grounds. Now he feels confident, he feels secure, he thinks he's winning, and the truth is that all the signs on the ground also indicate that he has the upper hand, that this can continue for a long time, but the rebels don't have a way of winning. He may not completely win, but he's in much, much, much better position. So he goes into Geneva meetings, if they do take place, with a great deal of confidence, and this report is just going to be brushed off by his people and himself.
But while Bashar al-Assad may feel he's winning, his country is losing. Is he in an alternative universe?
Well, he's not in an alternative universe. I mean, you have to define what you mean by winning. And in this particular case, and his supporters' case, winning is surviving. And all Assad has to do is survive. And as long as he survives, he's winning. Yes, the country is being destroyed, but he doesn't really care about this country. This is a family-run business enterprise that used Syria to enrich themselves to create a hegemony over the Syrian people. Whether or not people die and the cities get destroyed is of very little concern to him, obviously. But it is also true that we are seeing in Syria a fight to the death, that is, between the regime and its supporters, the Alawite minority, and most of the Christians, against a Sunni majority, which also, by the way, has now, which now includes jihadist elements who have also committed war crimes, but not on the scale that Bashar Assad, not on the systematic scale that Bashar Assad has conducted. That said, because the Alawites and the Christians see the opposition, the majority Sunni, as one that will come and essentially kill them all, for them, survival, in whichever form that takes, is victory. And on the ground, the Syrian army, with the help of the Lebanese Shia organization Hezbollah, with Iranian support, with Russian support, has not only withstood the onslaught, but is now pushing back in many critical areas. Earlier this year, we had a very famous battle in the town of Qusair, which was captured from the rebels, and we are now seeing another major battle taking shape around the city in the valley called Kalamun, which, you know, all of these are designed to create a corridor, if you want, on the western side of Syria towards the coast from Aleppo to Damascus. And if Assad can control that, he's happy. With the rest of the country, is not under his control, is of little concern to him, I think.
Again, I'm speaking with Ori Barkey, Professor of International Relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the U.S. State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. And he's authored, co-authored and edited five books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. So this finding from Navi Pillay, which has not been made public, she just announced in Geneva that there were massive evidence of war crimes, and she implicated the head of state of Syria. And while the list is confidential, apparently it's supposed to become the basis of an international investigation. But, of course, that won't necessarily go anywhere because Syria is not a signatory to the International Criminal Court, neither is the United States for that matter. And if to take it any further, you'd have to take it to the Security Council, and that would invite a Russian and Chinese veto. So not only is it not having any impact, apparently, it's not going to have any outcome.
That's correct. I mean, you do need the Security Council, and we have seen that in the Security Council, the Russians, especially the Russians, have emerged as the diehard supporters of the Assad regime and are willing to prevent or stop anything in the Security Council that would be egregious to Assad's interests. So this report is the report. If you think about the report, it is a moral condemnation, but the moral condemnation comes a little bit too late. It might not have had an impact in the sense that it would not have changed the course of the battle, maybe, but it would have had a psychological blow to Assad had it come earlier. At this stage, as I said, he has withstood so much, and because he's so confident of the Syrian of the Iranian and Russian support, that he's going to ignore it. And they can name names, they can say Assad is involved. All Assad is going to say, this is a biased report, has nothing to do with reality. In fact, none of the investigators were allowed to come to Syria to do the fact-finding. So there's a way in which Assad is going to protect himself from all these accusations, and he's going to live on another day to fight another day.
And meanwhile, Ori Barkey, the UK-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights has estimated the number of dead so far has reached 125,835 in this civil war, one-third of them civilians, 28,000 rebel fighters, and 50,000 on the government side, including both regular soldiers and the Shabia, the pro-regime militias, as including 500 dead from Lebanese Hezbollah. So what is going to happen then with this upcoming Geneva II talks, which the Free Syrian Army said that they will continue fighting during the talks, and Assad has said that he's not going to hand over power. And, of course, his opposition coalition says that categorically reject any role for Assad in any transitional government. So already they are drawing lines to make the Geneva II talks moot.
Well, Ian, that's right. I mean, you answered your own question. I mean, nothing's going to happen in Geneva. I'm not sure even Geneva is going to take place. It is in many ways a farce because the two sides cannot agree on anything. And their respective patrons or supporters are also unwilling to essentially push the parties to be more accommodating. And in this particular case, so what we should expect is that fighting will continue and you probably will see much greater involvement by Gulf countries and especially by Saudi Arabia in order to defeat Assad in Syria. And through defeating Assad, they think they'll be defeating Iran. I mean, you have to put a little bit the context of the latest Iran nuclear deal. I mean, the Saudis feel quite unhappy about the deal. And the one way they have to strike back at Iran is obviously not on the nuclear front anymore, but certainly in Syria. So you can expect that they will double up or double down, if you want, on support to the opposition. And it is a no-win situation. This is going to continue, unfortunately, for a long time to come. The big issue is the refugee crisis, which is getting worse by the day. I mean, today I saw some figures of another 20,000 going to Lebanon. I mean, more than a third of Lebanon's population now is Syrian refugees. So this will have a destabilizing effect on Lebanon for sure, but ultimately on other neighboring countries as well, and we're already seeing it in Iraq. So this is no longer just a Syrian conflict. It's a regional conflict. But unfortunately, I don't see, and I don't think many people can see, a way out. There is no way out. This is a civil war that's going to have to burn itself out, unfortunately, and will take many more thousands of people with it.
Well, Ori Barkey, on that grim but realistic note, I thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Ori Barkey, Professor of International Relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the U.S. State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. He has authored, co-authored, and edited five books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller, Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and most recently, European Responses to Globalization, Resistance, Adaptation, and Alternative. We're going to take a brief station break and be back with an analysis of the second Orange Revolution underway in Ukraine. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Alexander Motl, who is a professor of political science at Rutgers University, as well as a writer and painter. He previously served as associate director of the Harriman Institute at Columbia University, a specialist on Ukraine, Russia, and the USSR, and on nationalism, revolutions, empires, and theory. He is the author of a number of books, including Dilemmas of Independence, Ukraine After Totalitarianism, and The Turn to the Right, The Ideological Origins and Development of Ukrainian Nationalism, 1919 to 1929. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alexander Motl.
Thank you for having me.
And it does seem that the reenactment of the Orange Revolution is underway in the Ukraine, with the Prime Minister now saying that this has all the signs of a coup, and then of course President Vladimir Putin of Russia saying events in Ukraine seem, quoting, more like a pogrom than a revolution. So does this have the potential of drawing this domestic dispute into a wider foreign policy dispute?
You mean with Russia?
With Russia and, on the other side, the European Union.
Well, the Europeans are already involved. Keep in mind that the whole reason for these disturbances was the fact that the Yanukovych regime, Yanukovych being the president of Ukraine, turned down the association agreement with the European Union last week. This had been negotiated for something like 2 years. The vast majority of Ukrainians were eagerly anticipating their entrance into Europe. And then suddenly, for a variety of reasons, he gets cold feet and snubs the association agreement. So the Europeans have been actively involved up to these disturbances. They've been constantly cautioning the Ukrainian government, as well as Mr. Yanukovych, not to apply violence, not to apply force. And some Europeans have even participated in the demonstrations themselves. Russia, meanwhile, as you know, was actively lobbying and pressuring Ukraine, and especially Mr. Yanukovych, not to sign the association agreement. It had made it extremely difficult for Ukrainian products to be exported to Russia. There were long lines on the border. It was also saying that it would have to raise prices for energy and a number of other kinds of products should the association agreement be signed. So Russia has, as it were, already committed itself to opposing the association agreement. And now we have, to a certain degree, what is transpiring in Ukraine is reflective of this larger geopolitical contest or confrontation between East and West, between Western Europe and the United States on the one hand, and Russia with its, let's call it, its authoritarian and neo-imperial ambitions under President Putin on the other hand. But that said, it's, 90% of the impetus for the demonstrations are homegrown.
Well, there is, though, a lot of commentators have compared it to the 2004 Orange Revolution, which, of course, ousted the current prime minister. And at that time, I recall, Putin was blaming that revolution essentially on the CIA. So is there any recognition on the part of Yanukovych and of Putin that these are legitimate demands and desires from their people, I think the majority of whom want to be part of Europe, freer, less corrupt? I mean, it's pretty obvious, isn't it, that this is...
One would think so. I mean, Putin, strikingly but not unsurprisingly, has focused on one very small incident where it was actually the riot police that beat up some of the demonstrators. And then he twisted this very obvious instance of the riot police applying violence to the innocent population and called it a pogrom. Well, that's not surprising, given his predilections for propaganda and, quite frankly, mendacity. I mean, the man isn't exactly known for truth-telling. So he's trying to pervert the way that these events are being viewed in Russia. I don't think he has any illusions about the fact that the West, or more generally the world, sees this as the democratic aspirations of millions of Ukrainians. But of course, he's playing to a different audience. He's trying to appeal to his elites and to certain constituencies within Russia so as to be able to maintain his own position of power. Mr. Yanukovych, in contrast, he's been playing a bit of a game. On the one hand, you can be certain that he is absolutely terrified of what is currently transpiring in about two-thirds to three-quarters of Ukraine. That is to say, mass demonstrations, not just in Kiev, defections on the part of people within his regime, unwillingness on the part of the militia, the police, and some elements of the riot police to crack down. These are all the hallmarks of an incipient revolution. So he must be terrified, all the more so since he was humiliated once in 2004 when millions of Ukrainians occupied the streets of downtown Kiev and essentially forced him out of office. At the same time, he knows that he's got to walk a fine line. If he opposes these demonstrations too openly, if he were to side with someone like Putin and say that they are just illegal, that they're pogroms, that they're criminal or something of that sort, he leaves himself no place but for maneuver. So in contrast, publicly he said, oh, he supports peaceful demonstrations, and he's been shifting a lot of the blame for the mishandling of the demonstrations and indeed for the killing of the association agreement on his government and his prime minister. He's clearly trying to pass the buck and pass the moral buck to this individual, a man by the name of Azarov, who was widely, widely reviled in the country, almost as much as Yanukovych himself. And it's clear that Yanukovych is trying to place some distance between himself and what's actually taking place within Kiev. But let's, you know, we should be perfectly clear that he's terrified. This is a mortal threat to him and to his regime, and he knows it quite well.
And, of course, that would explain why he has condemned both the demonstrators and the police. Again, I'm speaking with Alexander Mutl, who is a professor of political science at Rutgers University, as well as a writer and painter. He previously served as associate director of the Harriman Institute at Columbia University. He's a specialist on Ukraine, Russia, and the USSR, and on nationalism, revolutions, empire, and theory. And he's the author of a number of books, including Dilemmas of Independence, Ukraine After Totalitarianism, and The Turn to the Right, The Ideological Origins and Development of Ukrainian Nationalism, 1919 to 1929. But given how this sort of has a bit of a repeat of history to it in terms of the 2004 Orange Revolution, which ousted this current prime minister from power back then, and now he's back in. He was elected, by the way, and largely because the opposition, who were swept into power by the Orange Revolution, ended up the two leaders ended up fighting with each other in a rather dysfunctional and public way. So where does it stand then in terms of the broader cultural issues? You're talking about up to three-quarters of the population wanting to be a part of Europe. Is that at the heart of it? Do you have a division in Ukrainian society between those who aspire for more freedom, openness, contact with the outside world, and those who are more comfortable with the kind of xenophobic world that Putin and his politics represent?
Unfortunately, that's still the reality. That was the case 23 or so years ago at Independent, and still the case today. I'd say roughly two-thirds to three-quarters. I mean, the numbers shift depending on issues and the time of day, but roughly that portion of the population has what might be called democratic aspirations, more or less liberal inclinations with certain fairly strong conservative streaks, and aspire to join something called Europe. Now, Europe can mean many things, many different things to many people, but generally speaking, there is agreement that it means democracy, the market, and some commitment to human rights and things like that. So you might say that that portion of the population consists of people who are more or less on the right side of history. Geographically, they extend from the far west of the country to roughly the area between Kiev, which is on the Dnieper River, and the eastern borderline. So roughly two-thirds of the country geographically, maybe three-quarters, is even encompassed by this zone. Then you get to the provinces in the Far East and South. There are about 3, 4, 5, depending on how you count them, which happen to be heavily industrialized and densely populated. So despite the fact that geographically they're a minority of the country, they do have a significant portion of the overall population. This portion of Ukraine's population is consistently most pro-Soviet, consistently most nostalgic about the Soviet Union. This is where the Communist Party is the strongest. This is where Yanukovych's own party of regions has its stronghold. This is where his own base happens to be located. And it's also the one that is most pro-Russian. Unfortunately, in Ukraine, antediluvian political preferences tend to go with one's commitment to the Russian language. That's obviously, I mean, there's no connection there logically. It just happens to be the result of historical developments. And these people, roughly one-third of the overall population, are the ones who are resistant to joining the West, are resistant to joining the world, do not like the market, do not like democracy, and would, if possible, press a button and either go back into the fold of Russia or some form of the Soviet Union. The good news is that the support that the opposition parties, the Democrats, have in these regions has been growing marginally, but it has been growing over the last 10 years. So in some places, they make inroads of up to 15, 20, 25%, which is significant. It's also significant that the younger population, the kids, you know, the 15 to 25-year-olds in these regions, tend to be rather more pro-Western, pro-European, pro-democratic than the, let's call them, the hidebound older generations. So over time, a shift is likely to take place, but unfortunately, at this point in time, it's still not clear where these people stand, and it's a good bet that they are looking eastward rather than westward. On the other hand, I'll just give you one example of what may be a very significant trend. There was a news program just today in this city called Lugansk. It's probably Ukraine's most conservative, most pro-Soviet, pro-communist, pro-Russian city. And it was a news program featuring a statement by the local party chief, one of Yanukovych's minions. And what the editors of the program did, as he was speaking, they ran a subtitle beneath his name saying, attention, this is disinformation. This is, in other words, these are lies. That's a remarkable breakthrough. And if this is in any way typical of tendencies in this city, then the number of people who were opposed to Yanukovych's rejection of the association agreement, even in Ukraine's east and south, may be significantly larger than we've always thought.
But on the other side, the dysfunction between the opposition who led the Orange Revolution, who had the power and fought amongst themselves, is that still a bitter legacy there? I mean, isn't that what happens when you have a democratic revolution and the people that pick up the revolution drop the ball?
That, unfortunately, I mean, that what you said characterizes exactly what happened in the period between 2005 and 2010. It was an extreme disappointment. The Orange governments under Yushchenko and Tymoshenko literally did virtually nothing except fight. And the result of that was that Yanukovych was able to win the presidential elections of 2010 fairly and squarely. There is no question about that. Now, what he's managed to do in the last 3.5 years is to prove that despite the fact that people thought that things couldn't possibly get worse than under the government of President Yushchenko, they can, and they did, significantly worse under him. Now, the question is, will the opposition, which currently consists of about 3 or 4 individuals, who have significant or some form of semi-significant support throughout the country, will they be able to get their act together in, say, some kind of post-revolutionary situation where, let's assume for the sake of argument, suddenly Yanukovych leaves and they're catapulted into power? Well, first of all, we don't know, but there are some grounds for being hopeful this time. One reason is that the opposition has been cooperating for the last 3 years, partly because they stand for roughly the same kinds of things, roughly. They do have disagreements, but mostly because, of course, they've been facing a common enemy, Yanukovych. Will their differences rise to the top if Yanukovych leaves? Here I'm somewhat hopeful. These individuals, let's call it the second orange wave, they have a precedent that they will be very careful not to repeat, that is to say, the failed Orange Revolution. They know, or at least they should know, what doesn't work. They should know what they have to do. That is to say, move quickly as possible in terms of introducing certain kinds of democratizing and economic reforms. Last but not least, what should make a very big difference this time as opposed to 2004 is that the Europeans are very much on the side of the Ukrainian Democrats. Back then, when the Orange Revolution broke out, the Europeans were lukewarm. They were stunned, they were surprised, and they were a little shocked by this crazy country's sudden desire to join the European Union. Now, of course, there's been 2 to 3 years of preparation for the association agreement. The Europeans understand that Ukraine has to be brought closer to Europe in some fashion, and they're willing to help out. And at least thus far, the Ukrainian opposition has also said that they are willing to cooperate with the Europeans. So that may serve as a stabilizing factor for a certain period of time until, let's say, elections take place and a new president is chosen, at which point the power struggles between the Democrats may be resolved, and with a little luck, the country might be propelled in a, let's call it, in a decent direction.
Well, just in closing then, Alexander Model, with this embattled president, Yanukovych, who is unpopular, and you say he's obviously terrified about what's happening, and he's saying things like any bad peace is better than a good war, and everyone must observe the laws of our state. What you have apparently there in Kiev's independent square are very, very well-organized protesters who are setting up almost a military camp there with barricades. Apparently, they're quite impressive. So it doesn't look like the opposition's going away, and it doesn't look like anybody's going to back down in terms of those that are pushing for integration into Europe.
Well, that's exactly the point. I mean, the opposition has stated very clearly, we are not leaving. We are not backing down. They've also shown that if and when the riot police were to cordon off some square and prevent demonstrations from taking place in point A, all they need to do in Kiev, due to its geography, is move 500 feet to the north, east, west, or south, and there's another huge square which they can occupy. In other words, they are there pretty much to stay. So the question then becomes, will Yanukovych dare risking using a significant amount of force, coercion, and violence? And the answer to that is really the answer to his fate. The problem he faces is that he can't rely on the Ukrainian army, which is underfed, underpaid, undersupplied, demoralized. I mean, these are not the kinds of guys that you're going to use in order to establish military rule. He can't rely on the significant numbers of the militia, the so-called the police, in other words. Most of these are recent recruits. Many of them are village boys. They, too, aren't necessarily overpaid, and they're not necessarily ideologically committed to him, which means that the only thing he's got at his disposal is several score thousand of riot police. Now, those guys are determined, they're competent. They know how to swing a baton. But you can't rule a country with several thousand riot police. Worst of all, if you do go in and crack down and employ violence, as they did a few days ago, that immediately has enormously negative repercussions within the country and outside. So outside, the world just comes in and condemns you, and Yanukovych is already isolated enough. He doesn't need that anymore. And worse, internally, if you crack a few heads, all that does is anger the remaining part of the population. So it just serves to mobilize the population even more. So he can't get rid of them, at least not easily, not without a very high risk for himself and his own stability. So they're likely to stay. So this standoff is likely to continue, and it's not inconceivable. We know this from history. We know this from looking around at other similar kinds of confrontations between people power and dictators, that the longer such confrontations take, the worse it is for the dictator in charge.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Alexander Motyl.
It was my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Alexander Motyl, who's a professor of political science at Rutgers University, as well as a writer and painter. He previously served as associate director of the Harriman Institute at Columbia University and is a specialist on Ukraine, Russia, and the USSR, and on nationalism, revolutions, empires, and theory. He is the author of a number of books, including Dilemmas of Independence, Ukraine and After Totalitarianism, and The Turned to the Right, The Ideological Origins and Development of Ukrainian Nationalism, 1919 to 1929. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with a critical analysis of China's recent assertion of territorial claims in the East China Sea.
On a slow boat to China, all to myself alone. Get you and keep you in my arms evermore. Leave all the others waiting on a faraway shore.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is June Teufel-Dreyer, a professor of political science at the University of Miami, specializing in international relations, Asian-Pacific political and economic systems, Chinese government and foreign policy, and U.S. defense policy. She was the Asia advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations and is the author of China's Political System, Modernization and Tradition. Welcome to Background Briefing, June Teufel-Dreyer.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
And Vice President Biden is visiting Tokyo and then on to Seoul, South Korea, and then on to Beijing. Of course, the Beijing trip already seems to be fraught with tension over these islands, these variously named islands, Sendaku by the Japanese and Diaoyu by the Chinese. Why is China making such a fuss over these piles of rocks in the middle of the ocean?
Well, they're very strategic piles of rocks, and China has been arguing for some time that the boundary line of its exclusive economic zone is where the Okinawa Trench ends. And the Okinawa Trench not only ends east of the east from China of the Sendaku, Diaoyu, Tai Islands, but practically off the coast of Japan's southernmost main island, Shikoku. So this bothers the Japanese a lot. And the problem here is that the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea is ambiguous here, because it says a state is allowed to have an exclusive economic zone 200 miles from its coast, but then it's aware that many countries' coasts are less than 200 miles, 400 miles away from each other. And it said in that case, they can establish the median line. So, of course, Japan wants the median line and China wants the Okinawa Trench. And nice. So that's where the thing has started. And it really only gained momentum. In fact, it was nowhere at all until a United Nations survey indicated that there might be rich oil and gas deposits in the area around the islands.
I see. So it's not a pile of rocks, then. It could be a pile of money or a pile of energy.
A pile of money. And I don't know why. And I've seen this referred to as, why are they fighting about a pile of rocks? What is the matter with people who say that? The Battle of Tarawa in World War II, you might say, was about a piece of coral. And yet the United States lost 1,200 Marines trying to take it, and the Japanese lost 5,000 men trying to defend it. The reason was it was part of the island-hopping strategy of the United States, and both sides knew it. So islands can be valuable apart from the fact that you can't grow, I don't know, coconuts on them or something.
Well, there's a submerged rocks claimed by both Beijing and Seoul. Now, you certainly can't grow anything on submerged rocks. What's the story behind that?
Again, that's an island that, well, it's a non-island, submerged piece of rock that is important to the South Koreans because of their coastline. And they have been having friction with China off and on. It's a very difficult situation for them to handle because not only is South Korea very small and right next door to China, but China has been able to play North Korea against South Korea successfully for decades now. Plus, the South Korean economy, part of the reason it's so prosperous is because it's running a trade surplus with China, and China could shut that off.
Well, indeed, that also
by turning a screw.
Sure. Well, indeed, that also applies to Australia, which is often referred to as China's quarry. And Australia's economy is very, very tied to its exports to China. And the Chinese foreign minister has said some very unpleasant, has rebuked Australia's new prime minister over siding with the Americans over these disputed islands. So, again, these islands are more than, they have become a foreign policy issue. And I'm wondering what Vice President Biden is going to bring with him in terms of some kind of resolution. And also, of course, I'm interested in finding out from you why you think the new Chinese leader is making an issue out of these things.
Oh, let's see. There's two very big questions there. For one thing, I am very dubious about Vice President Biden being able to solve anything. He has a penchant for talking at enormous length and saying very little. And I don't think that he is in a position to say, well, the Japanese and the Chinese should compromise, because that would essentially be selling out the Japanese position. And for better or worse, the United States has a treaty with Japan that this would undermine. And so he can't really do that. And I think even if he did, the Chinese would not be very satisfied with it. Their attitude has been, we discovered those islands first, which, of course, is a dubious proposition because there were obviously people finding those islands beforehand. They just may not have written down what they found. And but in any case, we discovered them first, and therefore they are ours. And that's really not a tenable position under international law. You have to do something besides find the islands first. You know, you have to set up markers and cultivate something on them and do something to assert your control over them. Just saying we came here in 14-2 will not do it. And let's see, what was the second part of your question?
The second part of the question is really to understand why there has been a change under this new leader, Xi Jinping, and what it is about him. Is he trying to assert himself? It seems like he overplayed his hand a little with claiming the airspace since the U.S. called his bluff with the overflight of the B-52s.
And not only the United States, but the Japanese and the South Koreans as well have been flying planes too. I do think that a desire to assert his authority is there, but of course this issue is not new. It's been coming up intermittently ever since 1971, I believe, was the first time China raised the issue, having not raised the issue for the previous, 75 years. So then it came up as a negotiating tool in the 72 deliberations on normalizing relations between China and Japan. It came up again in 78 when the Chinese were trying to get the Japanese to sign a treaty. I don't want to drag your listeners through an entire litany here, but it's been coming up sporadically and looking very eerie and very scary on a number of occasions. And in this case, you have a newly anointed leader, and he is anxious, I believe, to shore up his credentials with the nationalist elements in the country. And this is a very popular issue with most of them. And so another factor is that now China is in a position, a better position, to assert its claims. In 1972, it badly needed Japanese help modernizing its economy. It needed Japanese managerial expertise and capital. It no longer needs that. And it's also become a far stronger power militarily. So I think all of those factors play into it. And, you know, now Xi can do it because China has the power.
Again, I'm speaking with June Teufel-Dreyer, a professor of political science at the University of Miami, specializing in international relations, Asian-Pacific political and economic systems, Chinese government and foreign policy, and U.S. defense policy. She was the Asia advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations and is the author of China's Political System, Modernization and Tradition. So in terms of what China does, though, it seems a bit like Newton's law, where for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction, because the more China seems to assert itself, the more its neighbors seem to band together. And in many ways, the pivot to Asia that the Obama administration has identified itself with seems to be more to do with organizing China's neighbors as a bloc, and particularly the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which China is conspicuously absent from, would also indicate that there is also an economic as well as a political and military dimension to it. So is that the correct reading?
It may have been what was in Obama's mind when he announced the pivot, but with the United States facing very large budget deficits and sequestration really affecting the Defense Department in a very meaningful way, and the fact that the United States seems never to be able to extricate itself from the problems of the Middle East, which ties down a lot of our military assets, I wonder at the wisdom of Obama announcing a pivot, because the Chinese will just say, aha, this is a provocation, and we have to retaliate against it. And so before Obama ever thought to announce it, he should have taken care to look over his assets and say, does the United States have the assets to carry this out? And are our allies and friends in the Asia-Pacific region willing to band together with us to do something about this? And yet he really does not seem to have done that.
But what is the advantage of China asserting itself militarily if all that does is create kind of solidarity amongst its southern and eastern neighbors, all of whom, many of whom have traditional rivalries and all of whom seem to be nervous about China's hegemony in the region?
You know, Ian, there's an old saying, a parable about a bunch of mice who are afraid of a cat. And they are saying what we need to do is put a bell around the cat's neck. And yet none of the mice seems to be able to commit to put the bell, any of them put the bell around the cat's neck. And that's what I see happening. These countries are scared, indeed. And they say, well, we really ought to do something. But I don't really see them doing a great deal. And the reason is that to a greater and lesser extent, the prosperity of all their economies is dependent on Chinese favor. And we've seen what Chinese disfavor can do. When the Chinese and the Filipinos went at loggerheads over Scarborough Shoal in the spring-summer of 2012, the Chinese embargoed Filipino bananas and pineapples, and that's a $50 million market to a very poor country, and the Filipinos immediately backed down. And so the upshot is now China has muscled in on Second Thomas Shoal, and again, I suppose you could say that's a half-submerged pile of rock, but it's very important to the Filipinos, and they're not able to do anything about it.
But what is the connection then between having robust economic ties and trade ties, for example, with Australia, which Australia depends upon America for its defense and upon China for its solvency? So I'm wondering whether these things are mutually exclusive. Is there a suggestion that China's trade offensive could be followed up by a military offensive? Or are they, how are they linked? Well, the assumption's always been that the more, you know, using Winston Churchill's famous adage, jaw, jaw, jaw is better than war, war, war.
Oh, God, I wish Churchill had never said that. It's really stupid because what this neglects is that people can talk and still plan for war. So the idea that you engage a potential enemy in dialogue often means only that the enemy has more time to arm, enrich its uranium, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So Churchill may have been a great man, but that was not one of his greatest statements. And I stand on that one. Australia has the luxury that these Southeast Asian countries do not. It is far away from China. It never paid tribute to China the way, this is dynastic China many, many centuries ago, the way, for example, Siam and Okinawa and certain other places did. And as far as I know, the Chinese have not yet claimed that they discovered Australia first, so it should belong to China. And Australia, of course, is a very inherently solvent economy. It's better off because of trade with China, but Australians would not starve without it. Whereas other countries like the Philippines are really in danger of doing so if they displease China. So it's human nature. We all want to have our cake and eat it too. And so these countries are saying, well, we have to assert ourselves strongly with China without antagonizing China. And the Chinese, of course, know that. And so they wield the economic power. And if that doesn't work, then they are perfectly happy to send in the People's Liberation Army, Navy, and Air Force.
Well, but where's the evidence they've ever done that? Except in Vietnam at the end of the
Vietnam. Well, yes.
And they got whipped by the Vietnamese, in my understanding.
No, no, no. The Vietnamese withdrew. That was, I think, if you're talking about 1984.
Right, after the Vietnam War ended, yeah.
Yeah. I see. You were talking about 79. Yes, right. The Vietnamese did better there. Yeah. But I thought you were talking about the sea confrontation in 1984, and there the Chinese did win. The Vietnamese withdrew. Uh-huh. It's never come to that because the countries withdraw. For example, the Filipino boats withdrew in 2012. The Vietnamese raise a big fuss when their fishermen are chased away, but they do not come out with their gunboats and shoot. They just withdraw. The same thing has happened with Japan. The Chinese, after that fishing boat, remember the fishing boat in September 2010? The fishing boat that rammed the two Japanese Coast Guard cutters.
Mm-hmm.
And the Japanese arrested the captain and were going to put him on trial for damages. And the Chinese said, those are our islands, send him back. And the Japanese said, well, we have this legal system. And then the Chinese embargoed rare earths and subjected Japanese imports to China to this excruciating customs inspection, and then they arrested a couple of Japanese nationals for, quote, spying, unquote. The Japanese gave in, and they sent the captain back, and the Chinese said, and now our boats are going to patrol those islands, and they have. So that's what I mean. You being China in this case, you impose an economic sanction. If that doesn't work, and so far it has, then you send the boats in, and they don't need to fire a shot. China's military is so much stronger than any of the other militaries.
Well, just in closing, June Teufeldry, let's turn to the factor that we're not talking about, which is domestic Chinese politics and the extent to which these leaders that are trying to assert themselves in their region militarily also are looking over their shoulder at their very unhappy populace who are trying to push the envelope in terms of personal freedom and anti-corruption. And on the economic front, there's a huge black market in imported baby formula because Chinese citizens no longer trust their own products because of corruption. So how much do you think that inward pressure for reform in China is going to mitigate this outward military adventurism?
Well, it seems to work the other way, that the worse the pressures get inside China, and, China has just set up this National Security Council, and unlike the National Security Councils of the other countries of the world, its main function is domestic security, and the Chinese budget for domestic security is many times what the military budget is. They do fear their own people, but they have found that nationalism is a handy distractor. It creates an us versus them atmosphere, and so far that's worked. Now, I understand that this was something that the Russian Tsar tried to do in 1914? And that didn't work, and then you got the Bolsheviks in power. So conceivably it could backfire, but then again, China is not Russia.
Well, indeed, the Chinese are in power because they didn't follow Gorbachev's model of glasnost and perestroika. They've allowed perestroika, economic restructuring, but glasnost is off the table. And
how much really have they allowed economic restructuring? Because about 8 years ago now, market reform really stopped. And the state began re-entering the economy in a big way, so it reasserted control. And there's even a Chinese phrase for that, which translates into English as state advances, civilian economy steps back.
Well, June Teufeldreyer, thank you very much for joining us here today.
Always a pleasure. Take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with June Teufeldreyer, who's a professor of political science at the University of Miami, specializing in international relations, Asia-Pacific political and economic systems, Chinese government and foreign policy, and U.S. defense policy. She was the Asia advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations and is the author of China's Political System, Modernization and Tradition. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.